From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. In the 7 years since the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, billions of dollars have been paid out in settlements and spent on studies looking at the far-reaching environmental impact of the 210 million gallons of oil that spewed into Gulf waters. Today, we'll take a look at what it's done to marine life and the water itself with the scientists doing this research about the spill's lasting impact. We'll also discuss what researchers say oil companies and regulators are and are not doing to keep this from happening again. Plus, what does it take to be a 911 dispatcher receiving breathless, desperate calls for help from people in situations they never dreamed might happen to them? It's a job that requires training, patience, people skills, and an agile mind. We'll talk with Collier County's Communications Center supervisor about the new 911 center and the search for a few good dispatchers to join that team. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. 911 operators are usually the first people you interact with in the case of an emergency. Did you ever wonder what kind of training it takes for them to be prepared for anything when they answer your call? Later in the show, we'll learn about the people who answer those emergency calls, the dispatchers, and find out about Collier County's new upgraded dispatch center. But first, it was 7 years ago today that the world learned of an explosion on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. That rig was the Deepwater Horizon, operated by British oil giant BP, and the explosion and fire killed 11 people, injured 17 more, and began a series of events that led to the blowout of the oil well nearly a mile below the Gulf's surface. That well oozed oil for months, and before it was capped, more than 210 million gallons of oil, nearly 5 million barrels, had gushed into the Gulf. By 2015, BP and the federal government reached a nearly $20 billion settlement, the largest corporate settlement in history for what's been called the worst natural disaster in U.S. history and the worst oil spill the planet has ever seen. The full impact of all that oil on the water, shores, plants, and animals of the Gulf is almost impossible to know, but Florida researchers have been using some of the money from that settlement to track the long-term effects of oil exposure on fish and other organisms in the Gulf ecosystem. 7 years later, how healthy is the Gulf of Mexico? And how are we monitoring the ongoing fallout from the Deepwater Horizon oil spill disaster? Joining us to talk about their data and how it paints a picture of the health of the Gulf is Dr. Steve Murawski, a marine ecosystems researcher at the University of South Florida and a lead scientist for Sea Image, a team of 19 institutions spread across 5 countries studying the impact of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill on the Gulf of Mexico. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you so much.
Also joining the program is Dr. Kevin Main with Moat Marine Labs, who's studying the impact of oil on 3 types of Gulf fish species. Welcome to the show. Okay, well, Dr. Kevin Main, we'll find you eventually. And also, Dr.
Oh, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
Welcome to the show.
I wasn't sure if I was supposed to answer or not. I didn't hear anyone else.
Oh, okay. And also, Dr. Michael Parsons, FGCU Professor of Marine Science and Director of Coastal Watershed Institute. He's joining us today to discuss the direct impacts to the marine and coastal ecosystems along southwest Florida's Gulf Coast. Thanks for being here.
Hi, you're welcome. Good afternoon.
Today marks 7 years since the BP oil spill disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. What do you remember, and how were you impacted by the worst environmental disaster in history? Give us a call and share your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So first, Dr. Steve Murawski with Sea Image. As we've mentioned, it was 7 years ago today since the BP oil spill disaster played out in the Gulf of Mexico. The oil was coming out of a well on the seafloor nearly 1 mile down. Can you remind us why it took 3 months from April through September of 2010 to cap that undersea well?
Yes, thanks for that question. It was a totally unprecedented event. You know, the Coast Guard and all the agencies and organizations that prepare for oil spills, they usually prepare for the last one, and the last major oil spill prior to BP was the Exxon Valdez spill up in Alaska, and of course that was a tanker accident. People really were unprepared for a marine blowout a mile deep, and so there were no techniques that were available. Obviously, there were deficiencies in the equipment that was involved in terms of its maintenance and design, and really people had to figure this out from day one, in terms of actually how to turn that oil well off, and that was really an unprecedented event.
So Explain to me why it's so tough. I mean, is it because of the pressure and temperature down there when you're drilling below the surface of the Gulf? I mean, what happens at that depth that makes it so risky?
Well, the risk is, when you think about the rig itself is a floating ship, right? It's not anchored to the sea floor. And so you've got a mile of pipe string that goes from that ship down to the top of the sediment. And the well itself is probably another 1 to 2 kilometers below the surface. And so you've got this enormous string of single-point failures that can happen, right? The blowout preventer itself had redundant systems, but because of a variety of design flaws and technical maintenance, it didn't perform as it should have performed. In terms of what happens at a mile deep, totally different from what happens at the surface. What happens is the oil, when it's in the ground, it's saturated with methane. As it left the wellhead, the methane gas that was in the oil droplets exploded out. Those methane droplets formed ice crystals, you know, which originally BP and the government were trying to catch the oil with something called a top hat, which is basically, you know, like a flume hood over the top. The problem is it filled up immediately with these ice crystals. And so trying to, you know, actually figure out the what happens at, you know, 1,500 meters deep at 4.5 degrees centigrade, totally different than fighting a surface oil spill.
Yeah, just and then that didn't work. And then how did they eventually ever figure that out? How did they ever get it capped?
Well, the interim solution basically was to put another blowout preventer on top of the first one, right? And so basically what the government and BP did was slowly screw that second blowout preventer down to the point where they were able to control the well. And then the ultimate fix was actually to drill a second oil well and intercept this 21-inch pipe down below the surface, right, and then pump cement down into that intercepted second well, and that actually finally capped off the well.
I want to turn now to Dr. Michael Parsons with FGCU. In the end, nearly 5 million gallons of oil escaped into the Gulf. Well, not 5 million barrels. People remember the photos of the acrid smoke burning the oil on the surface and the beaches and animals all covered in the thick brown sludge. But Florida's population turns over so fast. Are there many here today? There might be some people around today who don't really know the impact that Florida saw directly and indirectly after that spill. So what did you and other marine researchers see in the months and years after the spill, and what kind of impact did it have along Florida's coast?
Well, for Southwest Florida, there was no direct impact. There was a societal impact where people were concerned about the oil reaching the Southwest Florida coast. Tourists were turned off by the threat of the oil, and so that hurt businesses all along the Florida Gulf Coast. Most of the impacts in Florida were seen up in the Panhandle region and elsewhere in the Gulf states, including Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Most of my experience has been in the Louisiana coastal marshes and salt marshes and seagrass meadows, and we still see oil there today below the surface. But if you're stepping in the marsh, if you're taking cores, sediment cores in the marsh, you can see oil layers there. So there is a long-lasting impact in terms of the environment with the oil. But for people, I think people are as resilient as these ecosystems are turning out to be. And they're in the process of recovering from any psychological or economic impacts. But it definitely was a real problem during and immediately after the spill.
It was tough. We were just coming out. We're still in that recession at the time, too. So it was kind of an extra double whammy. And then there was no oil actually coming up on our beaches, but our tourists weren't showing up either because this received so much national news for such a long time.
Yeah, and business deals, real estate deals fell through because of it as well. So there was a strong negative reaction by people in general out of fear for what the oil spill would do to the coastal environments of Florida.
Yeah, and it kind of exacerbated an already existing difficult economic time.
Right.
So you said that you were up in the northern part of the Gulf and you can see oil. I mean, what are you seeing? Does it look like, you know, like oil film sitting on water, or are they giant globs of brown stuff?
When you take the sediment cores and when you're in some of the areas where the oil is deposited, it is actually still gooey, tarry oil residue. And it's not as thin or viscous as, you know, fresh oil would be. Elsewhere, you do see weathered oil where it gets weathered to the point that it's almost like a hard, rubbery substance that continually
kind of dries
washes
out.
Up. Yeah, yeah. And you basically are removing either through light energy sunlight activity or through bacterial activity. It'll break down a lot of these compounds, and you're pretty much left with these asphaltenes and these very resistant PAHs or polyaromatic hydrocarbons that form kind of these, not really a tar ball, but more of a hard rubbery substance, almost like wafers or things like that, that can wash up on the beach still.
But those are still showing up?
Yes, yes.
Wow. Is there any prognosis to how long they think that's going to continue to happen?
It can happen. I think it'll be happening for years. And I know Steve and his team have been doing work elsewhere in the Gulf of Mexico with the Ixtoc spill, for example, down in Mexico. And Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm under the understanding that they're still seeing some of these residues washing up on beaches today after 30 years or so.
Yeah, Dr. Steve Mirowski with CMH, you worked with that Ixtoc 1 oil spill in the Gulf back in 1979. Can you tell me a little bit about that one?
Sure, and Mike Parsons is absolutely correct. There certainly is residual oil from that spill on the beaches, and we can also find it in the deep sea. Ixtoc 1 was really the first marine blowout of any substantial size that occurred. It occurred in 1979 and 1980, and it was in the Campeche region. It was in around 150 feet of water. That spill ran for 9 months and spilled about two-thirds the volume of Deepwater Horizon. It polluted the beaches all the way from the Yucatan up to the Padre Island in the South Texas coast. Again, it ran for 9 months before they were able to intercept that well. And we had a team down in Mexico last summer touring the beaches that one of our researchers had actually worked on that spill in the late or early 80s, and we retoured some of those places. And you could find, just as Mike said, some hardened, weathered oil in the mangroves, up on the stony beaches, and then in the deeper water, we're able to do core samples like we're doing up off Deepwater Horizon, and there, that oil persists there as well. What it basically means is that Deepwater Horizon oil is going to be with us in one form or another in the coastal areas and then in the deep waters for at least 37 years and probably a lot longer than that.
Well, there was significantly more oil, as you mentioned, that came from Deepwater Horizon. So is it mainly by drifts? Is it kind of all just going up towards Louisiana and Mississippi, up in that area? Is that where we're seeing it all, or is it possible that it can shift around and go into other places?
Well, the oil itself on the bottom is pretty much sequestered. What's happening is a phenomenon called marine snow is bringing both dead plankton debris and also other sediment to cap it off. And so we're starting to see an accumulation of sediment over the top of the layer that contains the Deepwater Horizon oil. That's in the deep water. In the shallow water, it is sequestered to a certain extent in the mud, and that's really not going anywhere. When you have a storm, you've got these sand tar patties at the what they call the toe of the beach in many beaches all the way from Louisiana all the way up to the Panhandle. And anytime we get a storm or hurricane, we're going to see tar balls from Deepwater Horizon up on the beach, and that's going to happen for a long time as well.
And Dr. Kevin Main with Moat Marine Labs, you're a researcher, and you've been looking at three fish species in particular in the Gulf and what happens from their long-term exposure to oil. What three species are you looking at?
We've been looking at the red drum or redfish and Florida pompano and southern flounder. All three of these fishes represent critical components of the fisheries in the Gulf of Mexico and three different areas of the Gulf that were impacted by the Deepwater Horizon.
So you chose them for that reason. What have you been seeing in them? Have they been impacted by the oil?
Well, our goal for our research was to take the information that we learned from the wild fish observations and then to get a much better understanding of what the long-term impacts are going to be of an oil spill on our fisheries in the Gulf. And so we chose these three species because each one of them occupy different habitats in the Gulf, and they were exposed in different ways. And so what we did, we're trying to do is tease out what the real impacts are of the oil exposure versus the combination of oil and other environmental factors. And so I'd like to give you an example of one of the impacts that we've seen. We've been looking at the long-term impacts on reproduction and fish populations in Florida Pompano. And that work has shown that fish that were exposed to oil have a reduced survival when they reproduce. The offspring, the ability to reproduce offspring is reduced significantly, both in terms of just the ability to fertilize eggs, and then once those eggs or larval fishes hatch out, the survival is significantly reduced. And so the long-term impacts are hard to tease out when you just look at the organisms themselves in the environment, but we're able to carefully identify what those differences are.
Yeah, today marks 7 years since the BP oil spill disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. So we want to ask people what you remember and how you were impacted by the worst environmental disaster in history. Call in and share your thoughts with us at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So Dr. Michael Parsons with FGCU, your research in the wake of this spill has been related to phytoplankton ecology, seagrass metals, as you mentioned, and salt marsh ecosystems primarily. So what impacts have you seen there? You mentioned that they were resilient.
Yeah, so I think one thing that we've learned is that it's complicated. And a lot of times when you look at the impacts on an ecosystem level, it depends on what your starting point is. Because we know with the change of seasons, with change in river flow from the Mississippi River, for example, you're going to have the communities responding differently, the animals and the plants and algae and things like that. So depending on when that oil spill occurs, that can change that trajectory in any given ways. But in a nutshell, basically what we've seen is that there was a phytoplankton impact. Some phytoplankton actually responded positively to the oil exposure and actually grew more, while many of them responded negatively. And so research that we did when we compared the phytoplankton during the oil spill in coastal Louisiana to baseline conditions before the oil spill, there was about an 85% reduction in phytoplankton biomass. So since that's the base of the food web, that could be a big concern. But phytoplankton reproduce so quickly, it doesn't take nearly as long as what Dr. Main is seeing with fish. They can reproduce on the order of a day or a couple of days. So while it may have been a dramatic impact, it was a very short-term impact.
Was there any difference when the phytoplankton did reproduce? They pretty much came out exactly the same. They didn't have any abnormalities as they continued to reproduce?
As far as we can tell, they did not. We didn't notice. Usually what you'll see is they just look a little strange. We haven't done any molecular work on the wild phytoplankton from the field during the oil spill. You might be able to see something in a molecular sense in that way. But usually we call it abhorrent forms, and we didn't really see any that were kind of weird-looking or anything like that. And with the salt marshes, in the salt marsh environments, the things we noticed were Louisiana has a problem with salt marsh erosion and losing salt marsh, and that's been a problem that's been going on for decades. And the oil spill, where the oil actually fringed along the edges of the salt marshes around the bayous and tidal channels, there's more salt marsh loss. So it's probably exacerbating the salt marsh loss that was already occurring. So that's not a good thing. But we've also seen birds being affected, not laying as many eggs, not nesting as much. Insects, many fewer insects, spiders. So you can see these other impacts.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering about is on up the food chain. We're talking about phytoplankton, but they may be able to reproduce and they may not look that strange. But, I mean, as they go into bigger animals and then those animals go into other bigger animals, has there been any research looking at the effects further up the food chain?
And that's where a lot of the complication comes into play, because you could have these ramifications. You could have a butterfly effect where these perturbations just amplify as you move up the food web. But with a lot of these organisms, they are recovering in terms of their reproductive capacity. We have seen impacts. I do not work with fish, so I will hand off to Kevin or Steve, but I do know there were fish impacts, and we continue to see impacts in the wild populations 5 to 7 years later. And there's a question as to how much longer are we going to see these impacts? Are these going to be permanent, or will there be recovery? But I personally do not know the answer to that.
Like, how long-term is the long-term?
Right, yes.
And Dr. Steve Murawski, I wanted to ask you, with Sea Image, overall, how would you rate the health of the Gulf 7 years after this disaster?
Well, that's a great question, and one I think we're starting to get on the anniversaries of this. It's decidedly a mixed bag. Some populations were heavily impacted, and they remain depleted or depressed, and some populations bounce back very quickly. And part of the issue related to that is what Mike Parsons said, and that is the life histories of the animals. We know, for example, that some of the sea turtle populations, their nesting success went down rather quickly, at least in the first couple of years. So Kemp's Ridley turtles, they nest in Mexico, but they spend their juvenile life up in the vicinity of deep water, and they had some issues. We've seen a displacement of sperm whales in the Gulf of Mexico to deeper waters after the spill, and some people have speculated that the area where a lot of the oil is, sperm whales eat squid, primarily near the bottom, and so if the squid populations are avoiding the area that's oiled, that perhaps the sperm whales have moved off. The fish work is really a mixed message. We have sampled a number of fish species that are associated with the bottom, and we see elevated levels of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are the toxic and in some cases carcinogenic parts of the oil. And those levels are quite high. In some cases, they've gone down, like for animals like red snapper, and in some cases, they remain relatively high for animals like golden tilefish, which is an animal that actually digs a burrow. We've seen reductions in the production of juvenile red snapper in the eastern part of the Gulf of Mexico. It's timed to be associated with deep water. We don't know if that's the proximal cause, but the level of what we call recruitment has not been as high as it was prior to deep water.
It's
so
kinda,
a really mixed bag.
Yeah, it seems like it's kind of tough to put a pinpoint on what is the cause of different declines, too. And we have a question coming in on Twitter, which is from the Calusa Waterkeepers, asking, what were the impacts on sea turtles? Eggs from nests were relocated, some of them to the NASA Kennedy for temperature-controlled storage. I guess that would be one of the immediate impacts, which would have been the sea turtle eggs that might have been on the beach. Do you know anything about that, Dr. Murawski?
Well, I do know that the primary impacts on sea turtle nesting, sea turtles, were actually the animals that were at the surface in the deeper water. Not necessarily the breeders up on the beaches. The primary nesting beaches for many of these turtle species are in Florida, for example, loggerheads. Certainly, they nest on both coasts. The Kemp's Ridley primarily lays their eggs in Mexico. You know, so even though a lot of the juveniles were killed either because of the oiling at the surface or also the mechanical and the burning operations that went on. Again, those populations took a dive, but they're back. I don't know what's happened with some of the nesting beaches in the northern part of Florida. The Twitter person is correct that some of those nests were dug up and the eggs were transplanted. I don't know what the outcome of that is.
Okay. Well, we have a caller on the line, and it's going to kind of shift our focus a little bit. This is Michael from Lake Placid. He wants to know something about a big, huge vacuum. So, Michael, what was your question?
I was curious at the time of the spill why there was not a giant vacuum ship standing by to suck up any oil spill and pump it into tankers for refinement, instead of burning it or dispersing it with more dangerous chemicals.
And that sounds like a question that maybe Dr. Murawski would be able to address. Is it possible to pull that stuff out of the water and then go ahead and use it?
Well, you know, at the time, there was some capacity, but nowhere near the capacity to deal with 60,000 barrels a day in terms of mechanical removal of the oil. There were a number of ships that were capable of doing this. One of the issues is the oil is very dispersed at the surface, so part of the operation there was trying to corral that oil before putting it aboard. There were a couple of ships that eventually came in during the spill, very large ships that came from, I think, Europe. One of the problems, though, is the ships are so large that it's very difficult to be on the watch for turtles swimming in the water. And eventually, those very large ships were not allowed to actually work in the area because of the potential downside impacts on the wildlife that was at the surface.
And so I wanted to ask another question. How sure are we that that is capped at this point? Do we go down and check on it to make sure it's not, leaking or anything?
Well, it's interesting. There were a couple of episodes where oil sheens showed up. One of the really interesting things is we can actually observe oil at the surface from satellites. And so there's a constant set of satellites out looking at the surface of the water. And you can see natural seeps from the bottom. They come up and they look as like a swirl or a sheen at surface. So if, in fact, there was a leaking oil spill there, we would see it in sheens from the satellites. And, there was some oil that was coming up from there about 6 months later. People were concerned that it might not have been capped. What it was is the pipe, again, there was a mile worth of pipe laying on the bottom. And they think that basically any residual oil in that pipe actually was leaking out. And so that sheen eventually stopped.
So, but they don't go down there and look. I remember back when it was happening, they had a camera fixed on it, and you could see it just flying out of there.
Yeah, there's no monitoring there now. Of course, the well is in fact capped, and so there isn't any other hardware down there at this point.
So then that brings me to today, and I'm wondering if there's anything that we learned from this Deepwater Horizon spill that has caused changes to the way that we drill at the bottom of the ocean now.
I'll take that one. It's there has been quite a bit of introspection going on and revision of some of the requirements by the government, basically the Interior Department. They have what they call a blowout preventer rule. They're trying to basically up the level of technology and the inspections for blowout preventers and up their standards, and that certainly has been done. I think the industry itself has actually come up with new models that are more reliable. There's also in place a number of capping devices that were not invented by the time of the spill last time, so certainly that's there. One of the interesting things, though, is that there have been no new laws passed by Congress to regulate deep water drilling since Deepwater Horizon. And that's really interesting and unusual because after Exxon Valdez, Congress passed and the president signed something called the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. And the Oil Pollution Act really modernized the standards. But the thing is, that was passed in 1990, and deep water exploitation of places like the Gulf of Mexico didn't start until the last half of the 1990s or the early 2000s. And so all of this deep water oil production and exploration was never anticipated under OPA 90, and there hasn't been any revision to that basic law.
And now, from what I understand, they're drilling further now, 2 miles deep?
Indeed. The deepest parts of the Gulf of Mexico are nearly 4,000 meters deep, right, which is over nearly 3 miles. And so many of the oil companies have, in fact, it was just a big lease sale going on in waters much deeper than Deepwater Horizon, out to around 3,000 meters. And so the risks involved in any kind of catastrophic accident really go up exponentially when you get as you go deeper in the Gulf. And so, that industry is pushing the limits of technology and our ability to actually control it.
and a lack of regulation. And then there's continued talk about deregulating oil and gas companies. Do you think there's anything that could be done differently when it comes to government oversight into these deepwater oil exploration projects?
Well, I hope so. You know, all three of us as scientists at one time or another have commented on the lack of what we call baseline environmental data, data that were available about contamination levels and the health of the environment the day before the accident. At this point, the oil industry is not required to collect periodic baseline data, and it's really unusual for any kind of potentially polluting enterprise. And I'll give you a for example. If you've got wastewater treatment facilities in all the coastal towns that discharge into the into a public waterway, they're required to monitor the health of that waterway in terms of pollution that they might be subjecting the waterway to. There is no requirement for the oil companies to do periodic monitoring, and so that puts us at a big disadvantage in terms of trying to assess what the impacts might be.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I do want to thank our guest, Dr. Steve Murawski with the University of Southern Florida and the leader of Sea Image, also Dr. Kevin Main with Moat Marine Labs, and Dr. Michael Parsons, FGCU Marine Science Professor and Director of Coastal Watershed Institute. I want to thank you all three for being on the show today.
You're very
welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie.
Coming up, the call no one ever wants to have to make, the 911 call to report an emergency. It's answered by dispatchers working in a command center. Coming up next on Gulf Coast Live, we'll learn more about the voice on the other end of the line and learn what you can do to help first responders do their job more effectively.